morning. As some people wonder about the value of neighborhood boards, at least one board has galvanized its community into an effort to halt a proposed development that would send 24 tour buses a day through its streets. And UH students have formed a food recovery network. We'll talk with the president of that group that delivers surplus food from the campus to the Institute of Human Services.
I'm Kathy Kozak. How textiles help beat the heat. We'll take a walk through clothing time with Honolulu Museum of Art's Sarah Oka and reimagining the great jazz hits with a contemporary twist. Nahoku nominee Patrick Von Wiegand's CD, Swanky 2, is going to be honored this weekend. He's here in the studio.
And it's Friday, May 27th. The conversation starts right after the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Kathy Kozak.
Good morning.
You've been enjoying your time with us this week. This is day five of your ordeal co-hosting the show.
It is day five. Beth Ann's coming back next week and it'll be good. I think I'm needed back in the office.
Well, we've enjoyed having you here, that's for sure.
Well, you've made it easy, Chris.
You know, we're talking about a lot of community initiatives this morning, and here's one. We know there's a lot of food going to waste in this world, and we also know that many of us undernourished are just plain hungry. It's an imbalance no one has been able to resolve on a global level, but we can at least make a difference in our own communities. And that's what drives Heather Fuccini, president of the University of Hawaii Food Recovery Network, which gathers surplus food from the UH campus and delivers it to those who need it most. Heather's with us in our studio. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thanks for coming in. What were the process? Take us through the process that led you to get this thing going.
Actually, it all started with a YouTube video my husband found online.
Is that right?
Yeah, through their national organization. And I was wondering if there was something like that already happening at UH, and there wasn't. Mm-hmm. So I got in contact with my community nutrition professor, and she put me in touch with Sodexo, which is our dining hall facilitator. And from there, we just got the ball rolling, and I found five volunteers to help me out, and we just did two official recoveries, and then we were an official chapter with the Food Recovery Network, and it's the first Food Recovery Network chapter here in Hawaii.
Tell me more about the Food Recovery Network. This is a national initiative?
Yes, it's a national program. There's over 180 chapters through different universities. It's mainly through university campuses. Mm-hmm. They donate all surplus food that is in the cafeteria to local shelters and food banks and stuff like that.
That amounts to quite a bit of food, doesn't it?
It does. Actually, since they started in 2011, they've already donated over 1 million pounds of food, which is 800,000 meals for hungry people. Because in America today, 197 million pounds of food is still being thrown away, which is 40% of food is being just thrown in the rubbish. And it's doing, it's actually 25% of all U.S. methane gases is from our food trash.
And that's perfectly good edible food that is just 40%, you said.
40% of all edible surplus food is just being thrown away. So we're trying to relocate that and give it to those in need instead of putting it in the dump.
So you had to enlist the cooperation of UH and its food vendor, and then you had to find somebody to give the food to.
We did, yes.
Which was IHS?
Yeah, we do. We bring our food to the IHS men's shelter. They have a full working kitchen that can store the food we have and serve it at the right temperatures. And from there, it goes to multiple shelters. It goes over to the women and children's shelter and the veterans shelter as well. Mm-hmm. So we're able to take our food there as the main hub and then distribute it out from there.
And how much does that amount to, say, on a given day?
Well, we've been averaging... right now we do once a week, and we've been averaging about 100 pounds every recovery. We have, since we started in December, we've recovered 2,266 pounds of food.
That's an impressive.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it really does. It really does make a difference. And the whole idea of getting I'm thinking about other people who might want to form similar mechanisms and So they'll have questions like, you know, are there some, you obviously have to meet some food safety guidelines, right, in handling food. Anytime you handle food, you've got to meet some yardsticks, yeah?
Yes, there are. The main national organization does send out training for us to safely handle the food. But we are, most businesses don't understand that we are covered by the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Act. And if we donate our food in good faith without negligence, we will not be held liable for anyone that gets ill from the food. And we can't be sued for that.
But that would be a question I think that a lot of people would have. Well, why don't more people do this,
yes,
right? So you, if you meet those criteria, what other criteria do you have to deal with?
We have to keep it below 40 degrees or above 140 degrees, depending on the food, and we have to be able to deliver the food within 2 hours. Food safety standards do permit 4 hours, but we try to keep it, you know, extra safe by just doing it in 2 hours. And then you also have to have a dining facility you can donate to that already has a working feeding program.
And you've got to deliver it to somebody who is going to be able to immediately refrigerate it.
Immediately refrigerate or serve it within the temperature required, yes.
And within that same time
within
frame,
the time frame.
More or less immediately when they get it.
Yes.
I'm just kind of, you know, sort of imagining this blueprint to create. And how do you let the community know about it? I love this little video that you made. Is it a video or a?
It's a PowerPoint
slide.
Yeah, it's a PowerPoint slide. We've been doing a promotion of hashtag Fight Food Waste. I've gone to a couple of different middle schools and high schools and reached out to them so they can start at a younger age realizing how much food is actually going to waste, and they can start to think about it and get the wheels turning on doing their own thing in the community. And we're trying to work with community outreach so that people do realize this, because most people have no idea that this much food is just going to waste.
When you do talk to, you were telling me you would talk to fourth graders about this. How do they react? Are they surprised?
They were very surprised, yes. They didn't know that much food was going to waste. Also, they didn't know that the biggest waste comes from farms itself. Because it's too expensive for farmers to go back out and pick up the food that wouldn't sell. So like an apple, if it's not pretty and it's not going to sell to the grocery store, then they just leave it on the ground and let it rot until it back under. And so Food Recovery Network, we are not doing this right now personally here in Hawaii, but Food Recovery Network nationwide is going into the farms and they're collecting this food that's being tilled back under. Well, obviously before it gets tilled back under, but they're going to donate that to food banks and stuff like that.
It really does seem as if the ingredients are there and the need is there for a much larger effort just across the board from all kinds of organizations. So I'm kind of thinking about ways that people can emulate you, right? How tough was it to recruit volunteers? I would think you'd have a pretty easy time of it once you explain what it is you're up to.
Yeah, luckily I am in the nutrition science department at UH. So we had fellow students that were very interested in it, and we do weekly email bursts and stuff, and they come once a week, and we rely solely on volunteers, and we've been pretty successful so far just relying on volunteers. We're working through the summer right now to pinpoint our schedule for summer, because it's kind of a little bit more difficult because everybody's either off island or doesn't have a car or something like that for the summer, but...
And you need, so you need what? You need a delivery component, right? Somebody with wheels to get this down every day and able to keep on a schedule.
Yes.
And perhaps a vehicle large enough to accommodate. What else did you, other needs did you have to meet?
That's actually pretty much it. We just have the working cafeteria. They're really helpful. Sodexo was so helpful with us. And then we just have to have aluminum pans, aluminum foil, a thermometer and a scale, gloves, and I just transferred everything in my car, usually. And it takes about a whole 20 to 30 minutes for us to do this. So, like, an hour total once a week, and we're saving this much food and donating it. So,
because I think it's the kind of thing, Heather, that a lot of people might think would take a larger effort than you described. But once you get it going, it seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, we're like pizza delivery guys, except for we don't get paid for it.
Well, that's a great idea. Thanks so much for coming in, Heather.
Thank you so much for having us.
A real pleasure. Heather Fuccini is a food science and human nutrition student at the University of Hawaii and is the president of the University of Hawaii Food Recovery Network.
This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, beating the heat the way our ancestors did. And later in the show, reimagining your favorite musical genre. But first, your quiz.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavaiti.
In today's backyard quiz, we're recalling the life of one of those globe-trotting adventurers who so often turn up in 19th century history. He'd been a gun runner in the Caribbean and was later thrown in jail in the Dutch East Indies after colonial authorities accused him of trying to start a rebellion there. He escaped and found his way to the Utah Territory. And after getting permission from Brigham Young to set up a Mormon colony in the Pacific, he came to the islands as a Latter-day Saints missionary in 1861 to establish a colony on Lanai, where he bought large tracts of land in his own name with church funds. Charges of embezzlement and abuses of Mormon doctrine led to his excommunication, but that didn't slow him down. He went on to serve the monarchy as a member of the House of Representatives, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Attorney General, Minister of Interior, and Secretary of War, and then in 1886 as Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Hawaii under King Kalakaua. It was quite a life, and we're looking for his name. Call us if you know it at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. We'll be back with your answer in a half hour.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Whole Foods Market Hawaii, Ulupono Initiative, and Hawaii Pacific University.
Do centuries-old Chinese garments compare to today's technologically advanced athletic wear? Well, both were made for moisture management, with the goal of keeping people cool in hot climates. Sarah Oka, curator of textiles at the Honolulu Museum of Art, has brought together an exhibit to trace the use of fabric from traditional times to the contemporary high-tech textiles we wear today. Sarah, welcome to The Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what inspired you to think about textiles as a way to deal with beating the heat?
One of the main things was last summer was such a brutal summer. It was so hot.
Oh, yes, it was.
And I realized that, you know, people have been dealing with living in humid climates forever. And I realized within the textile community, I mean, the textile collection that we have over 6,000 pieces, we had some pretty significant things from, you know, humid climates. And so I was able to actually take that from that same concept and bring it all the way forward to, today and realize that it was the athletic wear that was actually addressing a lot of that. Because for athletes, you know, sweat will kill. And so you needed to find a way to cool your body, eliminate the perspiration, and, you know, just be healthy.
So although our daily working clothes may not really reflect some of this ancient knowledge or ancestor mm-hmm. knowledge, it's actually athletic wear that does. But it's not just about the what you're wearing itself. There's a lot that goes into it. The fabric, the weave, the color. How does that all play a role?
Well, it starts at the real tiny fiber first. You know, certain fibers will actually absorb moisture better than others. But also you need fibers that will be able to evaporate that moisture because it doesn't help to just have that wet fabric sitting on your body.
So like bamboo might do that.
So there are lots of ways that they created sort of natural air conditioning within your garment. And so by raising it off your skin, you could create this barrier between your body and maybe your outer garment. So that's also a key factor, you know, having loose, billowy clothes that kind of keeps the airflow going.
I think about some of the countries now that have extremely hot climates. And when you look at the clothing that the people wear, it is sort of with that sense of being more gauzy, in some cases almost like layers, but they're a little transparent. That sort of is meant to allow them to exist in this hot climate and not feel super sweaty.
And the great thing is, you know, each area had to use materials from their own culture. So, for instance, from the Philippines, they have this beautiful banana fiber called piña. And that, again, it's very airy, very light. And it's just an amazing textile in itself. One of the other factors that they want to consider are things that kind of stay off your body. So things, fibers that are a little crisp, like hemp, rami, linen, and that also helps to keep it from kind of just sticking to you. We have one of the more amazing pieces that I just acquired. It's made out of paper string from Japan. And, you know, paper, it was used as another undergarment so that it would be a barrier between your skin and your outer garment. But it's just beautiful.
Now, the color also plays a role as well. Is that right?
Well, color is actually more of a psychological element. You know, if you wear something cool, the blues and greens, I think it just makes you feel a lot cooler than wearing something that's bright and red and yellow. So there's designs that go into it as well, you know, designs that can actually help you feel cooler.
Now, one of the interesting elements is that some of these garments that were really created and used by people, you know, 100, 200 years ago, also incorporated some all-natural antibacterial elements.
Yes, they used, in Japan, they used something called kakishibu. It's a tannin from the persimmon, and that actually has antibacterial properties. And the Japanese used to make this paper mat. It was layers and layers of paper that were laminated together and then coated with this tannin. And supposedly, sitting on that mat in the summer actually helped reduce your body heat. But it also had antibacterial properties. And so, you know, it helped keep the bugs away and it kept some of the germs. But it also acted as kind of a waterproofing agent. And the Chinese used something called the Shaolang Yam. And that they used, they dyed it with the yam and they also coated it with mud. And so, again, that also helped with having antibacterial properties. One of the other elements that they talk about was that it actually gave it a slight scent as well. And so it, you know, helped with...
hopefully a pleasant scent.
Yes. It was nicknamed the Sonorous Cloud Scent.
So it was actually, not only was it helping with antibacterial and also helping to keep sweat from causing someone to feel very hot, but it was also giving a nice fragrance around, sort of all-natural perfume. Now, what are some of the properties of today's garments that really harken back to what people have done hundreds of years ago?
So it's basically you want a fiber that's going to absorb the perspiration, but it's also going to have the ability to evaporate it. And that's what's going to keep you cool and keep your body heat kind of regulated. So I think because they're called microfibers, they're actually tinier fibers that they can create now, it can actually evaporate so much quicker than some of the natural fibers.
So when we look at what we're creating today, you mentioned it's mainly in the athletic wear genre.
Well, that was one of the key elements, I think, for a lot of the Olympic athletes. To that, so they could actually perform better because they weren't tired from being so hot and sweaty. So I think a lot of that was developed because of that. But of course, you know, people just going on a hike, people just doing, you know, smaller athletic feats could still benefit from that. So it is kind of mainstream.
Well, and I think you're talking about me doing smaller athletic feats. So I'm with you. I'm going to start looking at some cooling garments. That's why I don't like to go 10 miles. I'm too hot. All right. Well, I want to thank you for sharing the information about this exhibit, which you've curated with us today.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Oka is the curator of the textiles at the Honolulu Museum of Art, formerly the collection manager of the department since 1994. The textile collection comprises over 6,000 textiles and costumes from around the world, with a strong emphasis on Asian textiles. An exhibit, No Sweat, is on now, showing how textiles help beat the heat, and it's on at the Honolulu Museum through mid-September. Learn more at our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Will people ever read a newspaper on a computer? On Science Friday, we asked that question back in 1994.
If we don't change, readers are going to find what they need elsewhere. We've got to deliver more of what people need in the way they find it most useful.
I'm Ira Flatto. We'll look back to the future of electronic newspapers all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
$9.15, that's how much it costs to run this statewide network every minute of the day, which comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand that balancing a budget, and we are infinitely grateful for their support. Tanhan T. Jeter of Waipahu, Anthony Akana of Honolulu, and Rodney Katsura of Kaneohe. If HPR adds quality to your life, we invite you to become a member at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is open every minute of every day.
Good morning. I'm Ann Brandman from UH Manoa Outreach College. You're tuned to HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Many important decisions are made in the closing weeks of each year's legislative session, and it's not always clear, to the public anyway, what went into them. That pretty well describes the disbursing of so-called grants and aid, the funding on which many nonprofits depend. The good news is that more money has been distributed this year, but the bad news is we don't know much about the process of deciding who gets what. Chad Blair has the story from Civil Beat. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Chris.
There always seems to be kind of this mysterious shroud over the last couple of weeks of the legislative session, conference committees and ways and means, and all of a sudden bills get changed around. Does it seem that way to you?
Yes, it does. And this is a part of the process that a lot of folks don't know about, it, unless they're a nonprofit group, a community organization that depends on taxpayer money to help them do their job. Grants and aid, GIA, as they say at the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Nathan Eagle has shown a light on this process. And I'll just give you an example. More than 270 people applied, 270 groups,
mm-hmm.
for this GIA money. Only 104 got them. Yes, there's more money than there was last year, so that's good news, $37 million total. But some people were winners and some people were losers, and I'll just give you a couple of examples. The Blood Bank of Hawaii, they're getting money. Bishop Museum, Molokai Homestead Fairness Alliance, I hope I have that correct. And then people that are not getting money, people who didn't make the cut, Maui Economic Opportunity, Hawaii Habitat for Humanity, and the Legal Aid Society. They're just going to be without any taxpayer funds, at least from the state legislature this session. Why those decisions were made, how they were made, we don't know very much about.
Can an organization that didn't get what it asked for or didn't get anything, do they have, recourse? Can they at least get somebody to explain this to them?
Well, well, they certainly can apply again, and that's often what is done. But to try and get a lawmaker on the phone to explain why someone got money and someone else didn't is almost impossible. I know Nathan tried. He couldn't hear back from Ty Cullen, that's the representative in the House, or Jill Takuda in the Senate. He did get a call from Donovan Dela Cruz in the Senate, however, and he explained at least a little bit about what goes on. They try and make sure that they distribute the money fairly among the islands, the counties. Mm-hmm. They look at past funding. Have you applied before? Whether the money you're going to get is going to be used for a shovel-ready project, and whether it's having community impact. So they are trying to be careful at least to judge how taxpayer money is being used. But there is no rationale given, no explanation as to why this group got some money, another group did not.
Well, it's the kind of thing that I assume there's some effort to change this process underway on some people's part, yeah?
They've done a little bit. Recently, they required that the groups be from Hawaii, clearly have Hawaii business. That makes sense. But there was a bill to reform the standards process this session. Actually, Jill Takuda introduced it. That bill died, so there won't be any reforms anytime soon. But, you know, one model to look at is how the city does it, the city of Honolulu. They actually have an independent review board that decides which charitable groups are going to get money. That might be something that the legislature would want to consider. Having said that, there's a lot of politics involved here. A lawmaker loves to go back to his district and say, hey, look what I got, money for this, for that. Please reelect me. Maybe they don't use those exact words, but you know the sentiment.
I do indeed. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
We're going to the news in just a minute, but coming up right after the news, a musical tour back in time to the Jazz Age. And you can reach us here at Hawaii Public Radio on our talkback line. But right now, the news from the BBC. And we're back with the conversation. And this is the time on Aloha Friday when we hear from Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, about what the news department is up to. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Chris. On the verge of this Memorial Day weekend, I have a suggestion. If folks have 14 minutes to spare out of their busy lives, I'd encourage them to check out episode one of our podcast, Hawaii's New Ice Age, Crystal Meth in the Islands. It's done with additional reporting by our colleagues at Civil Beat. The first episode, which is up on the website now, if you go to hawaiipublicradio.org, you look in the upper right-hand corner, just click there, you can get that first episode. Mm-hmm. Really looks at an overview of where we are in what is now a crisis of three generations in yeah. Hawaii. It was 12 years ago that Congress had hearings, including a hearing out here in the islands about what it called the poisoning of paradise. Things got better a little bit for a little while, but now we're on dangerous ground all around the state on a number of fronts. This week, news in the headlines about the largest meth seizure ever on Kauai, 7 pounds, $1.6 million. If that is what comes in just that is captured by law enforcement, you know there's a lot more out there.
Sure.
And it's one of these stories, as you and I have discussed over time, that has a lot of strands.
Right.
And trying to follow some of those strands, trying to get more of those voices involved in the story is something that we put a lot of time to.
It's also the story that may or may not be as part of the 24-hour news cycle, but sometimes ongoing trend stories get neglected because of our hunger for what happened yesterday, right?
That's exactly
right. This is every day.
And taking that longer view and really, so for instance, as I mentioned, first episode does a bit of an overview. Next week, the second episode is going to take a closer look at what we call Hawaii's meth culture, why it is that this drug has such a lingering grip here.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to hear from people on the treatment side and the law enforcement side and the judiciary side a lot of common themes as to why that is. And anyway, it's also a perspective that our listeners may not have been able to get a chance, as you say, in that daily wash of news to step back
yeah.
and get a little more perspective on that.
And that's one of the things in any story about drugs, understanding the compulsion in the first place.
It's a complicated story. It's true, and it takes some time. And again, we're glad to have the opportunity to do that.
You're also looking into the background of one of the really beautiful moments of Memorial Day.
Yeah, the Lantern Festival. You know, that's always such a local highlight for Memorial Day, and the event itself, of course, visually stunning.
Yeah.
But there's so much effort that goes into the planning, the setting up of this. Molly Solomon figured that's worth a story. So she's been talking to a lot of the volunteers who get behind this every year, and we'll hear a lot more about that on Monday.
That's really one of the essential things to experience here in Hawaii, isn't it?
It is, and it's, again, the local flavor, but combined also with the good efforts of a lot of folks putting in their own time.
Yeah.
and volunteering. It's so much about our community, and it's worthy of a closer look.
That it is, Bill. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. It's Friday, which means we read your letters and emails. This came in on our talkback line after Wednesday's conversation with Auntie Hannah Springer about the proposed Ka'upulehu Marine Reserve.
Hi, my name is Lawrence Rose. I'm calling from the Big Island regarding the 10-year ban on shoreline fishing in North Kona. I've known Hannah Springer, and I respect her. Auntie Springer is a font of information about Ka'upulehu and that part of North Kona. However, the fishing ban, I believe, would be without point in conservation terms. I am against it. A 10-year moratorium on shoreline development would be much better for the fishery there. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for sharing your feedback. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Questions have been raised lately about the value of the city's neighborhood boards, and truth be told, most of us don't give them much thought until an issue surfaces within a community. That's what has happened in Manoa, where some residents, in the wake of a unanimous vote from their neighborhood board, have formed an organization called Save Manoa Valley to combat a proposed development on the Paradise Park site in the back of the valley. The Department of the Land and New Natural Resources, DLNR, is holding a hearing today on a proposal that would allow 430,000 visitors a year and 24 buses a day. Dale Kobayashi, chair of the Manoa Neighborhood Board, gave us the background of the protest in a conversation we recorded yesterday.
A lot of the reason that we formed Save Manoa Valley was based on outcry from people in the valley, that this was first became known to people in the valley after the approval was given in October 2014. Hit the news on television in November, so the following month. At that point, people started showing up the neighborhood board meetings and other community meetings speaking out against the park. So once it became apparent that a large part of the population was against the park, we mobilized and formed Save Manoa Valley. I'm the chairman of the Manoa Neighborhood Board. At the time, I was not the chair, but I sat on the board, and it was fairly obvious that a large part of the population was against this. So, and that they always had been. I've lived in the valley since 1965, and the same developers that have a number of different projects on that same property, and there's been a lot of community resistance every time. So it was kind of expected that we would see the same thing. And when that became apparent, we mobilized and decided to oppose the park's plans to build this tourist attraction. And the main points were related to the noise emanating from these attractions that historically have come out of the park, the traffic problems on a very narrow road up there of the 24 tour buses and the 400,000 plus people a year headed up there, as well as questions about the infrastructure in Upper Manoa being able to handle those additional visitors, and some potential issues related to environmental degradation. There's been identified endangered species up there, as well as a history of putting pollutants from the development up there into Manoa Stream.
Well, Dale, I'm curious that this is something that had already won at least a preliminary approval by the time you heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
So nobody in the community knew about this. So they apparently had discussions with DLNR dating all the way back to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of it is one could make a case that people in the Valley should have been looking at the DLNR agendas every month and seeing what is being discussed on this and should have known that this hearing was going to come. But in reality, few people do that. So people in the community had zero idea on what was going down here until it came out in the news. So there was an opportunity for the public to show up in 2014 and address this through testimony with the board in that hearing. Nobody knew that this hearing was going to happen, so there were zero people testifying on behalf of the community. So I think that's something you've seen in other situations similar to this in Hawaii, where there's always a question of how do you let everybody know adequately that this is happening. In a lot of cases, you know, the mechanisms out there, for better or worse, are imperfect.
And obviously, there's another side to this, and I'm just curious at the hearing what the other side is going to say.
So their side has really come out with the same type of issues that they plan to be good stewards of the Valley, that they considered the community. They made presentations to the neighborhood board from 2010 before I joined them. And one of their arguments is that in 2010, the board had favorable comments about the park development. It's a completely different board now, but apparently they were a lot more favorable to the park back then. So that's one of their arguments is that, well, the neighborhood board, which passed a resolution opposing the park in 2015, that was a resolution that I proposed, is not consistent with actions taken prior in the board.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that the board constitution changes constantly, and what we were in 2010, there's no overlap between that and what the board is made up of now.
Somebody's going to argue that what changed his mind in one direction can go the other way under a new board, right?
Right. So, and I think what needs to be understood is, and I think this is another issue being brought up, is that, you know, what the neighborhood board represents is a collection of, right now we have 17 individuals there. On the average, people in the Manoa board have not been that involved. We have generally about 10 people show up at the neighborhood board meetings. So a lot of what transpires there is based on what the board members have desired to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you look at the way we've tried to approach things now is try to get a lot more community involvement and have our views reflect that of the actual community, where I think when you look at the views that are expressed in the past, I think there were certain supporters on the neighborhood board of Paradise Park as a development historically, and they drove part that agenda to favor the park. Bottom line, Save Manoa Valley had over 1,600 signatures on our petition from people in the valley opposing the park. So I think when you look at the greater population, there's no wavering on this issue. Those members that constitute individual neighborhood boards, yeah, I think you could see some play there.
In terms of a lesson for other communities, it sounds as if you have to monitor pretty closely what's going on in your community, right?
That's a great lesson that I think, and that's why I think the neighborhood boards can be a force for good. Both that, and I think you look to your elected officials to let people know. They typically send out newsletters to constituents. They have legislative update hearings, and there's methods that can be used to spread word among the community so that, because I think your average person is not there looking at every agenda of the neighborhood board or the DLNR,
yeah,
or looking at the fine print in the back of the classifieds ad in the newspaper to see what's going on.
You might want to think about doing that in the future with this as an object lesson, yeah?
I've personally been doing that. You know, I look at all of these sources now constantly so that I know what's going on. I think that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I see the conundrum with the DLNR as far as, you know, they can't run television ads or full-page newspaper ads to let, mm-hmm, everybody know.
Mm-hmm.
So they're only somewhat limited. They can't send letters to everybody in the valley. So, you know, the lack of knowledge about what happened, I don't place that blame with the DLNR. I think they do what they can do, and it's really kind of a question on, you know, getting people involved, as you say, rather than changing the way we disseminate that information.
Dale Kobayashi is the chair of the Manoa Neighborhood Board, and you can learn more about the issue on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
I'll learn from the past. There's no other way that it should be. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kuanae kau I kau kau matoa. Ika e hu papa I nato. Kuanae kai liya. O kuru huana I genone.
Earlier in the show, we told you about a 19th century adventurer who made his mark on Hawaii in religion, journalism, and government. He came to the islands to start a Mormon colony on the island of Lanai. The problem was that he bought the land with church funds, but registered it in his own name. That eventually got him excommunicated for embezzlement. Undaunted, he turned his energies towards local media and politics, starting his first newspaper, the Nuuhau, in 1873. In 1878, he won election to the House of Representatives, and in 1880, he bought the Pacific Commercial Advertiser, the forerunner of Honolulu's current morning paper. He later served the monarchy in several appointed positions, including the posts of Minister of Foreign Affairs and Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Hawaii during the reign of King Kalakaua. His fortunes fell quickly after his appointment as Prime Minister. He encouraged the king to chase dreams of a pan-Pacific empire, an idea that turned Hawaii's international allies and the local business community against him. Today we asked you to name the man driven from office and forced to flee the islands. Walter Mary Gibson. He died penniless in 1889. It's 8:47. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Did you ever feel like you were born in the wrong musical era? That the tunes you love are mostly from a former time? What if you could live today and reimagine your favorite songs in a new way and find a group of musical friends to do the same? Welcome to the world of Patrick Van Wygant. He's a singer, producer, engineer, arranger, and he's been in love with the great sounds of the jazz age his entire life. He's nominated in two categories for the Nahoku Awards, Best Jazz Album for Swanky 2, and Best Video for My Valentine. Welcome to the conversation, Patrick.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, what inspired you to reimagine some of the jazz great pieces from previous times?
Well, I love the, by the way, I felt I was born in the right time. I really do. I feel so lucky that we got to grow up with all this rock and roll and the wonderful stuff that we grew up with from the 60s. And what really inspired me a lot was my parents. They played the old music. They played it in the house. And my mother played piano, so she'd play the old songs. And my father had, they'd have all these wonderful old albums. And then I was playing rock and roll with my friends, and it was wonderful. And all a lot of the musicians of the 60s really did pay homage, the Beatles and the Kinks, and there were a bunch of wonderful writers. And when Mama Cass sang Dream a Little Dream of Me, and John Sebastian was doing stuff with Love and Spoonful, it took us back to that time. So it was just a natural fit, and I think our generation really grabbed onto it, and we sort of acted like it was our own music, you know.
Well, and you've done a lot of great work with it. Tell me about Swanky 2 and what you have a lot of different musicians who have also been able to help you with this.
I'm very lucky. I consider myself the luckiest guy in the world. I know it's cornball and cliche, but I really am. I get to work here in Hawaii with so many wonderful players. On this particular album, Janai, a great singer, she's been here many times, and Pierre Grill, Dwayne Padilla, Emmett Mahoney, Alika Lyman, Greg Sardinia, and then I have a whole bunch of friends in California. That was Rusty Higgins on the saxophone, who's an incredible studio musician. He's played with Sinatra and Michael Bublé and everybody, and so we're friends, and I have a great group in California. So I was a studio engineer in Hollywood for many, many years, and so I have a good family of people there and here, and I've been lucky enough to mix them up, and they all kind of are amused. They laugh a little bit, but they say, "Oh, you're going to get the Hawaii guys?" I go, "Yeah," you know, and then, "Oh, you're going to get the California guys?" Yeah, so, you know.
Now, some of the songs on the album that you have are ones that people would recognize: Daydream, Sweet Mama, My Valentine, Sentimental Journey. How do you pick which songs that you want to have on your CD?
Chris and I were talking earlier about song selection. It's like the stuff that's in your heart, that's in, you know, it's in the ether right at that time when you're thinking of it. I make playlists on my computer, so I'll start thinking of an idea for an album, and I'll say, like right now I'm on the Swanky album, so I probably three or four of these songs, though, friends have said to me, you should do this. And that's the fun thing of once you start something, that you start, you know, and then your other friends say, oh, that would be good for you. So on this particular album, my piano player friend, Harry Donahue, said, you ought to do Daydream. And I tried it a couple times. We switched keys around. I was like, brilliant, you know. On the earlier albums, I was working with Sonny Silva and the Hot Club of Hoolaville. I was recording their albums, and they were very helpful. All those guys, they'd say, oh, you ought to try this one, try that one, you know, Ain't Misbehaving or something like that. And so it's usually other guys and gals who, like, will say, try this one. And, of course, just I'll hear a song and I'll say, I love that, I want to do it, you know. So Janai and I both heard My Valentine, which was a throwback to the old songs from Paul McCartney. And both of us at the same time said, we got to do that. It wasn't a duet, but we said we got to do it, so we did it as a duet.
And reimagined it a little bit.
We did. Oh, well, I like our version a little bit better than Paul McCartney's. If he ever hears this, he'll hit me, but, you know. We put a trumpet and vibes in, and it was kind of different, you know, so it was nice. He did it with an orchestra, excuse me, but, you know.
Hey, you got to love what you're doing.
I'm having a good time.
Now, you were going to play a little bit for us today.
Well...
Tell us a little bit about what you're playing.
Oh, dear. Well, let me just throw in, I'll put a tad bit of the John Sebastian song, which was from the 60s. It was from his group, The Lovin' Spoonful. And we thought it would be a good start to Swanky 2. And I'll just do a little bit of that. What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. I've been lost in a daydream. Dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun, falling my face on somebody's new mowed lawn. And on and on. And the studio version, we have violin on with the wonderful guy John Lambden. And great musicians on it. So,
well, it's a good song for the morning, too.
Tis. And it was just another one of those songs that it just, wow, this feels right. So we gave it a little bit of an old twist. One more. This one, friend Dennis O'Hanlon suggested years ago, and he said, you got to do this. There are blues that you get from loneliness. There are blues that you get from pain. There are blues when you long for your one and only, the blues you can never explain. There are blues that you get from sleepless nights, but the meanest blues that be, I mean the meanest kind that I got on my mind, blues my naughty sweetie gives to me. Oh yeah, there are blues you get from women when you see them going swimming and you haven't got a bathing suit yourself. There are blues you get much quicker when you're drinking lots of liquor and somebody goes and takes it off the shelf. There are blues you get when everything's in hock, when your girlfriend doesn't answer when you knock. There are blues you get from getting in the taxi cab and fretting every time you see the bumper jumper clock. There are blues you get from trying to keep your Uncle Bill from dying and he afterwards forgets you in the will. There are blues you get from kisses when you're walking with your missus and another girl says, hi, Bill. But the blues that make you want to drop, stop, shake, shiver. The blues that make you want to go end it in the river. The blues my naughty sweetie gives to me. The blues my naughty sweetie gives to me.
Now I can see why you're loving it, jamming with your friends, and having a great time. I want to thank you for coming on today and playing a little bit for us live in studio. You weren't anticipating it. We made you do it anyway.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. This is great.
All right. Patrick Van Wegen is a lover of the jazz age. His swanky CDs are a fresh take on some of the most elegant and wonderful songs ever composed. He wanted to take us on an affectionate musical tour of the jazz age with his swanky friends, and as a result is nominated for 2 Nahoku Awards. He'll be at the event this Saturday. More information at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Derek Malama. The 2016 Nahoku Hanohano Awards will be given out this weekend. And on the next Kanikapila Sunday, you'll hear music from several of the award winners, plus songs from the latest releases by Raiatea Helm, Hoku Zudermeister, and Ian O'Sullivan, plus the Kanikapila Sunday Classic. Please join me for Kanikapila Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m.
Kathy, musicians love songs from the 20s and 30s because they're full of, one thing, hip chord changes, but also really witty lyrics like that last song, The Blues My Naughty Sweetie Gives to Me.
I can't even imagine how you remember all those words.
I know. But those patter tunes are almost like a comedy routine matched to a song. Yeah, lots of
you
fun.
Could have seen us. We were laughing here, I'll tell you.
That's right. That's right. Well, I love when we have a chance to have live music performed on the show, and I sort of kidnapped Patrick, your guest, and pressed a guitar upon him in the hopes to hear some of his music. But that was a lot of fun.
Hey, and you did great.
And Kathy, we want to thank you for being with us this week. It's been a lot of fun. I hope you've enjoyed it because we loved having you.
I'll do it again sometime.
Please do. And that's it for this week. Coming up next week, Henry Curtis, Executive Director of Life of the Land, will sit down and talk with us about proposed wind farms in Kahuku and offshore.
Plus, the Battle of Midway anniversary in commemoration at the Pacific Aviation Museum. We'll talk with Bert Burlingham, the museum's historian.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you've ever wondered about the music you hear on the show, you can find the playlist on our page, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants. And Alex Abe is our intern.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMillo. I'm Kathy Kozak.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.